The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a brilliant author, screenwriter, and producer who's here to discuss his brand new multi-award-winning documentary feature film about one of the greatest female vocalists in the history of pop music, Karen Carpenter, who with her brother Richard formed a duo, The Carpenters, and became the number one American music act of the 70s. The movie is called Karen Carpenter, Starving for Perfection, and it chronicles not only her spectacular career, but also what was going on behind closed doors, her quest for perfection, resulting in low self-esteem, a disappointing love life, and a battle with anorexia, which resulted in her tragic death in 1983 at the young age of 32. We hear about Karen's personal struggles in her own voice through never-before-released recordings and through the voices of legendary stars who knew her and were inspired by her music, including Carol Burnett, Olivia Newton-John, Suzanne Somers, Kristen Chenoweth, Carney Wilson, and others. Here's the trailer.
Karen's voice is one of those voices that just goes right to your soul.
It's arguably the most beautiful voice that anybody will ever hear.
And that voice, you know, that voice.
Perfection is just about impossible, but that's always in my mind, you know.
There was a very loving, happy part to her, and then there was a kind of a darkness there.
There's no way to be able to handle that kind of success.
There was something about her that she didn't like about herself.
I had no idea that I could do a blasted thing.
She definitely battled her self-image.
She never had a successful romantic relationship.
Love is something that I think everybody in this world has to have, and without it, you're not worth anything.
She was a very sensitive human being, and she was incredibly injured.
No one really knew a lot about anorexia back then. It wasn't something that was really talked about.
When I got sick, it scared the hell out of me. And I said, whoa, down to the old 89 pounds there.
My God, Karen, what did you do to yourself?
You don't really know when you step over that line.
How were you born with that kind of talent, that extraordinary genius talent, and then sabotage yourself?
Maybe she never wanted fame.
Perfection is a battle you'll never win.
You could have fame and the most beautiful voice in the world and still feel a hell inside.
I don't think Karen Carpenter's true story has really been told.
You can't stop. The only way you can stop is die.
We've only just begun to live.
The movie, which is now available on the eventive.org streaming platform, is a captivating, revealing, and unvarnished documentary providing astounding new insight into Karen Carpenter's tragically short life and enduring musical legacy. Our guest who wrote and produced this movie is a best-selling author who's written three books about the Carpenters: Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter, Yesterday Once More, The Carpenters Reader, and Carpenters, An Illustrated Discography. He's also published two books about Judy Garland, entitled Judy Garland on Judy Garland, Interviews and Encounters, and Becoming Judy Garland. And in 2018, he released a great book entitled Dolly on Dolly, Interviews and Encounters with Dolly Parton. I'm delighted to welcome Randy Schmidt to our show. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I think you got it on there. That was nice. Thank you.
Randy, first of all, your movie is getting rave reviews at film festivals everywhere. Congratulations on this wonderful film, which, to be honest with you, made me cry like a baby at the end.
Well, I appreciate that it was moving to you and that you were, touched by Karen's story. That was definitely our goal, to tell a story that maybe hadn't been told about her before. And as you mentioned before, in her own words, a lot of times. So we were able to unearth a lot of amazing interviews and things that hadn't been heard before.
Randy, you are clearly the expert on the life and career of Karen Carpenter. What was it about her that captivated you so much?
The voice was unlike anything I had ever heard. It was so hard to describe, and sometimes still can be. You know, people liken it to velvet. I don't know. I think people struggle trying to equate it to anything because it's so incredibly unique. But what all of us who kind of get the Karen bug could agree is that it seems like she's singing only for us. There's such a conversational approach to her delivery of a song. It's not this, okay, everybody stand back, I'm going to wow you with what I'm about to do here. You know, it's just her communicating a song in a way that so few singers really do effectively. And it spoke to me as a 13-year-old kid when I first saw the TV movie, the Karen Carpenter Story. And for the last 30 years, it's been really a constant for me. I've never encountered any other voice that's affected me in quite the same way as Karen's.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It's all about that beautiful, perfect pitch, haunting voice that had such emotion in it and the intimacy that made you feel she was singing only to you. You know, when we had Richard J. Alexander on our show, he said that in his opinion, Karen Carpenter had the perfect pop voice. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think she could have done just about anything in the pop genre for sure, and possibly beyond that. I mean, there are lots of signs that she would have made a great jazz vocalist. And I mean, she could sing the American Songbook like nobody else. And as evidenced by, you know, a variety of classics and standards that the Carpenters covered over the years, there's also a great medley that she did with Ella Fitzgerald on one of the Carpenters' television specials in 1980.
Now, as you know, there have been several films about Karen Carpenter. In 1987, there was a short film called Superstar, The Karen Carpenter Story, that was made with Barbie dolls. In 1989, there was the TV movie, The Karen Carpenter Story, produced by Richard Carpenter, which you've alluded to. And in 1998, there was a documentary called Close to You, Remembering the Carpenters, in which Richard Carpenter actually appeared. And then in 2016, there was a TV movie called Karen Carpenter, Goodbye to Love. So with all of those films already out there, what made you decide, Randy, to make this film?
I think that our approach was definitely different on this film. Of course, you know, several of those you mentioned were more of the docudrama, the movie of the week variety. And when I was approached to do this, it was really discussed as possibly bringing my book, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter, to life in a documentary form. And I like that because so much was revealed in my book that has not been present in these other documentaries. I was able to get into a core group of Karen's friends who came forward and said, you know, we're never asked to talk about our friend because, you know, the family has controlled this story for so long that now it's you know, Richard's version of what happened. And he basically brings in the same people to talk about it if he knows that they're going to tell his version of the story. But I mean, these were women who were with Karen. One of them I'm thinking of in particular was her day-to-day best friend who was Karen's matron of honor at her wedding. And she's somebody that had never really spoken on record. She had given a lot of stories to the guy who wrote the screenplay for the TV movie, The Karen Carpenter Story. But when Richard found out they were working together, he was furious and started trying to delete a lot of those scenes that were really, I think the truth was a little bit too difficult to take at that time.
Well, that I think is the most significant aspect of what you've done, because for most people, the TV movie, the Karen Carpenter story, was the definitive story. But because of your film, we now understand that because Richard Carpenter was the executive producer of that movie, there was a lot of whitewashing of the facts to protect the family and specifically himself and his parents. What details about Karen's story do you think Richard did not want the public to know?
You know, I do feel like there are a lot of family secrets that will probably never even be revealed about the Carpenters, because there were things that were apparently bad enough that Richard made, you know, a financial agreement with Karen's ex-husband to never speak about their marriage or anything having to do with the Carpenter family again. And it just doesn't quite make sense based on even knowing what truths I do know. I feel like there's still something that is, you know, of being avoided. And I do think there is another level to this story that will probably never go uncovered. And, you know, Richard will probably take with him whatever it is that keeps him from really sharing who Karen was and who she was as a person, not just as a great vocalist, because, you know, he talks to great ends about who she was as this amazing vocalist, but her personality was such in a way that you just can't ignore how unique and unusual and just exciting that she was as a person and as a friend. And that's what I was able to get, I think, from that group of girlfriends of hers.
Do you know if Richard Carpenter or any member of the Carpenter family has seen the movie?
I have not heard if they've seen our documentary yet at this time. I think from what I've been told from friends who are still somewhat close with Richard, that he really just doesn't even want to talk about it, or doesn't even want to go into a lot of those things. So I think as he has aged, possibly he doesn't get as into maybe policing those things as he did before. You know, he knows the story from my book that I have to tell, and that would be explored and expanded upon in a documentary form. And unfortunately, you know, he was never one to get on board with that.
So can I assume then that you didn't make any effort to try to get Richard to participate in the movie?
We didn't, just knowing that with his participation in other documentaries and other events and programs and things like that, there is an editorial control that he pretty much demands. I knew that we wouldn't be able to tell the full true story if we had him involved. And I think, you know, it's explained without really being explained in the documentary. People can see why we wouldn't want that control to come into this project.
Well, no, he had his chance with the made-for-TV movie.
Right.
You know, I was very struck when Suzanne Summers said in your film that when Karen died, two deaths happened, because a big part of Richard died as well. And of course, that's true. Do you know how he's doing?
I do know that he's married. He has 5 children, young adults. His children are all still fairly young and, you know, pursuing careers and in college and that sort of thing. I think that's really become his focus in these past few years. For a while, he would kind of dabble in music here and there, maybe arranging something for someone or producing maybe a single song for someone, things like that. There was this elusive Christmas album that we were supposed to get an instrumental Christmas album from Richard Carpenter, but it was just sort of teased for off and on for about 20 years. I just think that he lost his muse with that. And you know what Suzanne was saying in the documentary, when she said, when a death like that happens, you know, it is two deaths, because it's the death of Karen, but the death of that act as well. Because as phenomenal as a musician as Richard is, there's no holding a candle to what Karen was and brought to that team, because there are a lot of phenomenal producers and pianists and arrangers, but there's really only one Karen Carpenter, and it would be, I think, hard to go on after that. After having worked with the best, it might be difficult to find your muse after that.
Oh, for sure. You got a lot of big stars to appear in the movie. Carol Burnett, Olivia Newton-John, Suzanne Summers, Kristen Chenoweth, and others. Was it difficult getting them to participate?
It's always difficult when you send out feelers and things to different performing artists, and you never know what you're going to get. You never know if they're actually going to be the one to make the decision, or if their handlers just decide for them, no, that's not for them, or whatever. Occasionally you do get to them, and that's what was important with Karen's story. If people were asked directly, I think a lot of times they go, oh yes, Karen Carpenter, I'd love to talk about her. And luckily we had a really great group of people that came back to we probably sent out, well over 100 inquiries to various artists that either worked with Carpenters or were inspired by their music. And to have those that came together to work together so well in a documentary was nice too, because you never know how everybody's opinions are going to fit together and how the stories will mesh. But somehow with this varied group of people, we were able to get, a really clear story and a clear view of who Karen was and why she's so important.
Randy, one of the things I learned from the movie that I'm sure a lot of people don't know is that at the very beginning, Karen got a solo recording contract, but her mother put a stop to it and said the record company had to take both Karen and Richard, or they couldn't have either of them. How do you think Karen reacted to that?
I think it probably was on track for what she had experienced with her mother, Agnes, before that as well, because I'm sure it took Karen by surprise too. She didn't think she was anything of a singer. She didn't even necessarily think she was that much of a drummer until, I think she started hearing from professionals that she was really that good. There was definitely a confidence in the drumming, though, that maybe she didn't have in the singing early on. She really considered herself a drummer who just happened to sing. And at this particular audition for someone else, it wasn't even she or Richard that were auditioning. They were playing for a friend of theirs. And at some point during the night, she opened her mouth and sang. And the guy said, basically, I don't want this trumpet player that was here to audition for me, but I want that girl. But yeah, it came with that stipulation, I think, that kind of went along with Karen for the rest of her life, that Richard's going to be a part of this no matter what. And with rare exception, that's how it was.
I got the sense from the movie, Randy, that Karen's mother, Agnes, was overly controlling. What impact do you think she had on Karen's emotional issues?
I have more recently been looking into the dynamics of Agnes and Karen and Richard, and it seems very much like there might have been some narcissistic issues and tendencies from the mother. As far as, you see this traditional golden boy in Richard, and he can do no wrong. And that's what, Karen's closest friend said. Richard, in his mother's eyes, could do anything. They owned, this will show you how Agnes thought of Richard, that he really could do anything. They owned a set of apartments that have kind of become famous over the years in Downey, which is where they were from, but they own these apartments called Close to You and Only Just Begun. It was just a real estate investment for them after they started making some of this money. But when there would be issues with water or electricity or different things, I'll send Richard over right away, as if this, pop musician, pianist, is going to, but that's what she thought. He knows everything. He can solve any problem. And the contrast of that, though, was that Karen could do no right. She was sort of the scapegoat in this situation and kind of saying, well, look what I can do, or but she had been trained really from the time she was a little girl to facilitate Richard's talents. And we're all here to support and encourage this amazing you know, concert pianist. We're going to have the next Liberace right here in our family, is kind of what the thought was. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't think Karen got the attention that she desired from her mother. It was usually in a negative way if she did.
Well, that comes through very well in the movie. For the first few years, Karen played drums on stage. It was a way for her to hide, but then Richard decided she had to be up front. Do you think that was hard for her?
Absolutely it was. But I think we should qualify too, though, that she loved the drums so much. It wasn't just a place that she could hide. It was that kind of place of solace and, you know, a little bit of a security blanket. But more than anything, she just loved playing the drums. And I think that that was her primary instrument. Like, that's what she considered to be her biggest talent. And the voice just happened to appear. Yeah, I think that that was definitely a difficult time for Karen, because she had been able to rely on just being one of the guys, so to speak, in the band, and being able to hang out behind the drums and sing. And, you know, she didn't really have to get out and be in the spotlight. You know, a lot of people, including Richard, will say, though, that even if Karen had been a homemaker, a teacher, a secretary, I mean, it's obviously very sexist sounding in this day and age, that she would have still had these eating issues. She would have still had the issues with anorexia. And I think that goes to show it really wasn't the spotlight on her that may have contributed to it, but it was something that was bound to happen anyway because of this. Well, her best friend described it to me as a hole in her heart where the love of a mother should have been, and that was really the catalyst for all of this, and that Karen just wanted to make herself disappear, really.
Well, she was raised in an environment where her brother Richard was considered to be the genius, the real star. And it's pretty clear from the movie that Karen was uncomfortable being more famous and more popular than her brother. Do you think she may have felt guilty about that?
To some extent, yes. I think she felt guilty that there was so much focus on her and her talents, and that people would say, well, who's this guy and what does he do? And you can tell from some of the interviews in our documentary, and some that I had never even heard until we located them for this particular project, that she was fierce in her being adamant that he was the one that deserved all of this attention. And, you know, he does this, he does that, he produces, he arranges, he orchestrates. And I think that she was quoted one time saying, and all I do is sing. But it's like, that's, you know, usually the people who orchestrate and arrange and all of that are in the background. We only see them in the credits. So he was already, you know, a big step ahead of that by being half of this duo. But it really, I think it was difficult for her to be the one who got the spotlight, the celebrity, all the attention, really. But she was the one also that had the personality, that was able to connect with people. And Richard wasn't that. He was great at what he did, but she really was the face and voice of that act.
Do you think it bothered Richard that she was more popular than him, and that the public didn't really understand that he was the brains behind that act?
To some extent, yes. I think Karen was more concerned about it because her mother was so concerned about it. And she wanted to keep things, you know, she wanted to keep things in balance and in check with her mom. And I'm sure mom was upset that, you know, they spent more time on camera with Karen at whatever the particular taping might have been, or, you know, Richard wasn't getting enough attention, or we need to put this camera on his hand so that we can see the talent that, you know, Richard has. It was that kind of thing. Richard. And I don't know that Richard himself was wanting that, but it was definitely instilled in him that he deserved that attention from a very, very young age.
Karen made a solo album produced by Phil Ramone, but the album was not released during her lifetime. Was Richard to blame for that?
not solely. I wouldn't say Richard was solely to blame for that. And I think if Karen had been stronger, she could have fought for that more. It's interesting that A&M Records released Ethel Merman's disco album the same year that this album was deemed unreleasable by the brass at A&M. So because it contained some disco flavored tunes and some things that they just didn't think were quite up to standard for, you know, this person who had sung We've Only Just Begun and Rainy Days and Mondays. That was never the point with this project, for her to, you know, recreate the success or sound or anything of Carpenters. And I think it was a chance for her to get out and show what she could do, pick her own songs. And I just wish it had had a chance to either, you know, shine or fail, whichever one it was, because whichever of those it was, it would be, I think, easier on her in the long run, more so than if it was just deemed, no, this is, you know, to say it nicely, what Richard said is this is crap. And she wanted his approval really more than anything. Like, yeah, little sister, you did it. This is, you know, great work, you know, and now let's get back together for our next Carpenters album or whatever. But I think it was seen as such a threat within the family that she would do anything without him. And as her best friend, Frenda, told me, there were sort of blinders by the family that they didn't think that you could do more than one thing, that they felt like it was, you know, her abandoning Richard to do this project versus her taking a detour and trying something different. And then, you know, they saw it as like, is she trying to end the Carpenters? And I think the record label got behind Richard in, you know, their response to Karen, their somewhat kind of disappointment over what she had recorded and was presenting to them. And it was devastating to her. Phil said that, you know, they walked out of the onto the A&M lot after having played it for Richard and Herb Alpert and some others, and that she was completely devastated. They took her, Phil and his wife took her to Mexico on a vacation for a week or so after that, and they said that she was just like a shell of herself. She couldn't believe that this thing that she had poured all of her heart and soul into, and quite a bit of her own money. She invested about $400,000 of her own money to be going back and forth to New York to record this. And yeah, I think that it was really kind of the first big blow that she had to endure over those last few years of her life.
Such a heartbreak. Now, as you know, Randy, the music critics back in the 70s were not always very kind to the Carpenters. They said they weren't cool. They made fun of their goody-two-shoes, squeaky clean, wholesome Pollyanna image. How do you think that affected Karen's self-esteem?
I think she was able a lot of times to kind of consider the source, because they would send these rock and roll reviewers to review the Carpenters. And of course, they weren't of the rock genre. And so if Lester Bangs from Rolling Stone comes to review a Carpenters concert, he's probably going to make fun of it. And they got some really wonderful reviews over the years from people who got it, who understood their brand of music and what they were doing, and you know, the quality in it. And you know, I just mentioned Rolling Stone, but Rolling Stone also had Tom Nolan, who did, you know, he was in our documentary, and he did a cover story on Carpenters and had the utmost respect for them and their handiwork, I guess you could say, in the recording studio. I mean, he was able to have access, like a lot of reporters back then, and you don't see that today, but where they would tour with the star or be in the recording studio with them. And so he had that kind of access, and I think was able to give them a little bit more of a fair shake in a publication that wouldn't necessarily be known to like the Carpenters. But yeah, I think the image bothered them somewhat, because it was kind of created from the record label and the record covers and jackets and photography and everything that they generated, that publicity machine that puts you out in this light, that they kind of create a biography for you, and then you're supposed to make that your story, if that makes any sense. But then there were times also that the Carpenters I think, didn't realize that they were even making it worse. They would try to overdo things, like say, oh, well, we believe in the legalization of marijuana. Or they would say, well, we've had premarital sex, or whatever it might be. And it just seemed silly that they would have to go to those lengths to try and come across as having some sort of edge or something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's just a shame they just couldn't just be themselves and be appreciated for the magnificence of their talent. Karen's favorite song was I Know I Need to Be in Love. And although she was very briefly married, her husband turned out to be a con artist and he broke her heart. She never found happiness or had a really fulfilling romantic life, did she?
No. Unfortunately, you know, Karen never was with anybody long enough. A lot of times to do with, it was, you know, the result of her career and the amount of time that they were traveling. There were times that they did over 200 concerts a year, 240 something concerts a year. So they were on the road all the time. And she was the only one that wasn't really allowed to date on the road or to really meet up with people. She did on occasion, but you know, it was common for the guys in the band to go out and have a different girl in every city. And it was common for Richard to bring along his girlfriend. In fact, one of his girlfriends was the hair and wardrobe person that we interviewed for the documentary, Maria Galeazzi. And she was, you know, she started just as Karen's hairdresser and then very quickly got into a relationship with Richard. It wasn't the same for Karen. She couldn't really have a guy travel with her on the road or anything like that. She had a few boyfriend situations over the years, but nothing super serious. And I really think it was that rejection of the solo album in early 1980 that led to her being so adamant about getting married at first sight. Like, they knew each other like 2 months before they decided they were getting married, and it was really just a disaster. But Karen wouldn't listen to anybody. I think she thought she needed to do something to take control. She needed to have some sort of control in her life. So, okay, I'm going to be independent and I'm going to get married and going to do my own thing and, you know, get out of the house, so to speak. And unfortunately, she picked the wrong guy, and it ended up just exacerbating things as far as her illness, and was really just yet, like I said, another blow that you can kind of see this progression or regression of things leading up to her death.
Oh, yes, for sure. It's just like a Greek tragedy unfolding. Do you have a favorite Carpenter song?
It changes from time to time, but the one that always stays, I feel like, at the top of my list, and the one that I would share with somebody if I was wanting them to know all the great things Carpenters could do and Karen as a vocalist, I love Superstar, which most people are like, what's that? Because it doesn't have the name Superstar, of course, in the song, but it's the Long Ago and Oh So Far Away. And oh, it has the haunting melody that, you know, Karen does so well. It has the incredible arrangement that Richard did with the echoing horns and things like that in the background, and all those lush stacked harmonies from the Carpenters that's just trademark Karen and Richard. So Superstar from 1971 is definitely my favorite.
Oh, that's right at the top of my list too. I think my all-time favorite is Merry Christmas, Darling. There's just something so sad about her tone. The loneliness comes through, even though it's a song, it's a love song.
You think of holiday songs and Christmas songs as being joyous and uplifting. And of course they aren't all that, but that's one that definitely from the opening, you know, piano chord and greeting cards, like people are like, oh, as soon as they hear it, either like, oh yes, or like, oh, this is so sad.
We learn in your movie, Randy, that Karen saw herself on a TV show in a Bob Hope special wearing a gold pantsuit, and she thought she looked fat. Do you think that was the trigger, the impetus for her eating disorder?
I think that was when people started to notice it externally, her going from more of an hourglass figure to being like a straight up and down you know, like almost beanpole kind of appearance. And it was that particular television appearance that made her tell Richard that she felt she looked heavy. And she said, I'm going to do something about it. And then within less than a year, she had already dropped down to, you know, close to 100 pounds and looked great, looked fantastic. But then it never stopped after that. It became, as Tom Nolan, the writer, says in our documentary, when he first met Karen, she was trying to lose 10 pounds. And she never stopped trying to lose that 10 pounds. It was always not enough.
Randy, there's a very chilling moment in the movie. You played a clip from an interview in the UK where the interviewer asked Karen outright if she had anorexia. And we see Karen's angry reaction. She's furious. Randy, that's very disturbing. And it haunts me to this day because you can see the denial in Karen's face. You can hear it in her voice. That's a very, very crucially important moment in your film, don't you think?
Oh, it is so painful to watch and to know what she was going through, or imagine what she might have been going through in that moment, because she had really been able to keep this private for quite a long time, especially from the public. And then to be on this television show and be asked, is it true that you have the Slimmer's disease, as she called it, anorexia nervosa? And yeah, you see that immediate terror in her face and anger. But you know, she's saying, you know, no, that was a long time ago. Like that was something that happened, you know, in 1975 when she had first lost the weight. She talked about it in past tense. And yeah, it's just super painful to watch, especially seeing the condition that she was in health-wise at the time of that interview.
Were there any surprises for you about Karen in researching and making the movie? I mean, you seem to know so much about her, but was there anything that surprised you?
You know, I do feel like I went into this kind of knowing most of the big secrets that I felt I could reveal up until that point. I was open to new things coming along, but this was really more of an exploration of the themes and stories and things that I was able to reveal in the book. And so I don't want to say I didn't have any surprises, but most of my surprises were, you know, the people that we got to come and talk about her, or you know, happy surprises like having Carol Burnett sing Do You Know the Way to San Jose when she's remembering what it was like to sing with them. And so it was more like happy surprises that we could take the book to a new place with this documentary, but not so much like this revealing thing, you know, came out to me at that time, which was what did happen with the book. There was this point in time that I realized, wow, this book just took a turn and I'm going to have to get real serious. I'm not going to be able to write this like, you know, some fan that just fawns over everything. Like, I've got information here that is super important, and I have to approach this with, you know, a way that's not just a fan who's writing about this singer that he loves, but I have to really become a biographer now. It's kind of how it felt.
What was the most challenging thing about making the movie?
The most challenging part of making the movie for us was really timing, actually. We had started this documentary back in, I think my first meeting with Andy, our executive producer, was back in 2018. We spent, you know, 2019 seeking out a lot of the interviews that we were going to do and starting those interviews. But then, of course, like everybody else, everything came to a shutdown in March of 2020. And we just kind of had to work with what we had for a long time. We were able to do a few pickup interviews and things once everything sort of opened back up. But that was definitely the biggest challenge that we encountered. As far as the content and everything, I don't feel we had too many challenges. Just getting the people that we wanted sometimes, and it would be a, you know, maybe an email that was such a huge disappointment. Somebody I wanted to interview declined, but then the next day somebody else came in and it was, you know, a huge celebration. So it was a lot of emotions and excitement throughout the entire process.
Carney Wilson, who's a member of Wilson Phillips, is the executive producer of the film, and she's been quite open about her struggles with eating disorders. Her own personal connection to this issue and what she has to say in the film about the relevance and importance of eating disorders adds a great deal to the significance of this movie, don't you think?
Carney was one that, yeah, it was a surprise. I knew that she was a fan of Karen, and I knew that she, you know, just that she loved the music, and she had recorded Merry Christmas Darling on a Christmas album of her own. And she was one that was a big surprise, though, because the level of understanding that she had for Karen, even though their situations were quite different, there were similarities between what they were going through and the issues with body image and food and that sort of thing was something she could definitely understand. It was a surprise to me. Here's a surprise. How about that? I did have a surprise after all, that Brian Wilson was such a big fan of Karen Carpenter and would listen to Carpenter's albums at home. And to hear Carney talk about him and his love for Karen and how he was influenced by Carpenter's harmonies, I don't think anybody knew that, probably not even Richard Carpenter, that not only were they fans of the Beach Boys, but the Beach Boys loved the Carpenters.
I was very surprised to learn from the movie that at least 30 million Americans have an eating disorder, and every hour, someone in America dies from an eating disorder. In a very real way, Randy, Karen Carpenter's death awakened the world to the problem of anorexia, and you and your fellow filmmakers deserve a lot of credit for shining a light on this issue.
Well, thank you. I remember when our director came forward with those statistics, and even though I felt like I knew a lot about the eating disorders from having studied them and Karen over all these years, those statistics were absolutely shocking. And, you know, we've had people all along the way saying, oh, this film needs to be, you know, shown to young people in health classes and things like that. But I've had others say, you know, I want to show this to my niece who's going through something similar. And it is very much of a cautionary tale, but, you know, people who are in that don't necessarily respond to the cautionary tales. So that's a tough thing too. You know, had Karen been shown somebody else who had an outcome similar to hers along the way, would it have changed things? I don't know. She was so secretive and so, you know, private about that part of her life that she may have continued right on. I don't know. But yeah, we were definitely able to, I think, tell a story that hopefully will reach people, even if it's one or two people. But I think Karen's death overall, I mean, the only thing that has come from it that could be considered positive is the attention that was cast upon the idea of eating disorders being deadly, and that it wasn't, you know, somebody just being stubborn, not wanting to eat. This is a actual, you know, psychological disorder. And I think that may be, you know, we talked earlier about reasons that Richard doesn't want this story out there. It's difficult for people, especially of his upbringing, with how his mother felt about the idea of, you know, psychology and things like that, that admitting that something might be wrong is just not okay, especially in such a perfection world of the Carpenters. Admitting that there might have been issues with parents, admitting that everything wasn't as squeaky clean as we thought, I think that's probably what might be the hardest thing for him at this point.
Well, Randy, I'm going to go out on a limb here, not only as a fan of Karen Carpenter and as a fan of your movie, but as a retired family court judge who saw numerous cases of anorexia throughout my career. And I'm going to suggest to you and to our viewers that while I think it's wonderful for young people to see this film and learn about this disorder, my hope is that parents of young kids see this film, because your decision to name the movie Starving for Perfection was extremely inspired. And I can tell you that from my own observations, not clinical, just anecdotal, the need for perfection is what drives anorexia. the desire to be perfect. And that desire often comes from overly demanding parents who have obsessively high expectations for their kids, very often girls, much more frequently than boys. And this is a very cautionary tale that when you have kids, regardless of how talented they are, it's very important to make sure that they understand that they have worth, that they have value, and that they are loved and accepted and cherished, whether they make it big or not. Thank you, Randy, for letting me vent, but I really love the fact that you named the movie exactly what the source of the issue is, a need to be perfect. Somebody in Karen's life, probably her mom, made her feel that she needed to be perfect, and you nailed it. And I'm so proud to have you on our show and to have this opportunity to tell you publicly that despite all the other movies and books that are out there about anorexia and about Karen, you really nailed it.
Thank you. You know, the thing with the title was troublesome for me for a while, because as a Carpenters fan, there is that tendency to be overly protective sometimes of Karen. And when that title was being discussed, I knew that there would be a certain segment of Carpenter's fandom that would be against it from the beginning. And we do have several that I know of that are quite outspoken about never seeing a film with that title, because they think it's disrespectful to Karen. But I do appreciate your view on that, because it helps me to I think feel better with it after all this time. I know that I discussed it with our executive producer and all of those who worked on this film at AMS Pictures. And I was really the only one saying, I don't know. I knew I didn't want like the traditional goodbye to love, or I need to be in love, you know, naming it after a song. But they were really pushing for a documentary that went beyond Carpenter's fans. And they wanted to reach, obviously, a different audience. And I think you're right. I mean, it really does nail what the theme of this is, and the fact that perfection is that goal. And yeah, this being a cautionary tale for parents makes a lot more sense than it being a cautionary tale for the person who's in the middle of, you know, the throes of an eating disorder.
Well, it's a tragedy that Karen Carpenter ended up being the poster child for anorexia. That's not what any of us wanted for her. But I have to tell you that I believe that wherever she is, wherever her soul is, I think it would bring her gratification and some comfort to know that her death wasn't in vain, that her message is out there, thanks to your book, thanks to your movie. It's been such a pleasure meeting you, Randy. Congratulations on the great success of your movie. On behalf of all the Karen Carpenter fans out there, thank you for making this movie. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Absolutely. The pleasure is mine. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been author and filmmaker Randy Schmidt, whose film, Karen Carpenter, Starving for Perfection, is now streaming on the eventive.org platform. You can find out more information by going to the movie's official website, karencarpenterdoc.com. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my production assistant, Rose Apuzzo, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.